You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
This is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm honored today to have as my guest Carlos Fuentes. This is his second time on the show. My listeners, I think, will not need reminding that he is the author of The Death of Artemio Cruz, Aura, a very great ghost novella, Terra Nostra, a mammoth novel, The Hydra Head, The Old Gringo, Christopher Unborn, Constancia, and other stories for virgins, The Campaign, and most recently, this new collection of linked novellas called The Orange Tree. I congratulate you for having written a book entirely narrated by the dead and the non-existent. It's very much a ghostly book, it seems.
Yes, yes, it is forms of discovering how we perceive life from death, what happens to us when we die, how conceivably we could look upon life from the other shore.
It seemed as if, as a result, the world here has become something of a necropolis with, nevertheless, a living orange tree at its center. What does the tree signify for you?
I think very obviously it signifies nature and the fact that it survives us, that it goes on, that it witnesses our follies, our historical madness, and survives. Yet what I imply in the last story, the Christopher Columbus story, The Two Americas, is that for the first time in history, we might deny nature its privileges and take her to the grave with us. Through nuclear holocaust, through ecocide, we could conceivably be the first generation that achieves this monumental apocalypse.
It's very rare for a quote on the back of a book to be significant to a book, but it seems to me that in this case, Guy Davenport's quote, which I'll read, is very significant to this particular book. Davenport says, in all his books, Fuentes draws tight a tense conjunction of opposites, the sensuously beautiful and the horrifyingly ugly, innocence and evil, past and present, the familiar and the strange, nature and culture. And in this book, all sorts of twins recur. There are, as the story says, two Americas. There are two sons of Hernando Cortez who speak a story together. There are two translators and a story called The Two Shores, The Two Numantias. Because this book seems to be, have at its core, an interest in envy and resentment, whether, I wondered if you could speak about that.
One way of looking at the world is in a binary fashion, a world of opposing forces, opposing doubles. I think the commentary by Davenport, who is a great writer and a great critic, rara avis in that sense, is very, very correct. It's almost as though Davenport had forecast this book, The Orange Tree. And in the Two Numancias, I go back to one of the first philosophical preoccupations, which is the difficulty in conceiving the relation between body and soul, between flesh and the spirit. It is something that has preoccupied humankind from the very beginning. The very first philosophers immediately speak of this. Are we one? Are we two? Is our flesh one thing and our soul another? Why do we die? Because our body ceases to function. Where does our soul go? It has been a constant preoccupation, this binary construction of ourselves and therefore of the world. The story of the Two Numancias, I think, dramatizes this in the decision by the Roman general Scipio of defeating Numancia, the last Iberian stronghold, to hold out against the Roman troops by duplicating Numancia, by creating a perimeter that exactly duplicates the area of the city. But what the city sees in this mirror of itself is a barren, no man's land. It is almost an invitation to suicide, an invitation to surrender. But at the same time, it is reflecting the divided nature of the man who ordered this, who is Scipio, a Roman general who is a part of a famous military family, yet he is an adopted son. He knows he is a stranger to that family, a divided man, taken into that family. And also he is a military man who is an intellectual, who is the founder of the first intellectual circle of Republican Rome, with men like the historian Polybius or the playwright Terence sitting around the orange tree in his courtyard and creating a rhetoric for Rome, a rhetoric for imperial Rome for its future. This is a dramatic event, I think, in all people's lives, this idea of division, the possibility of duality, of being separated from ourselves. And I wanted to dramatize it in order to go forward in my own conception, which is underlying the whole book, of what is reality, a question about what is reality. Is it the purely subjective? Is it the purely individual? Or is it the purely objective, the material world? Well, both exist, but I do not understand the existence of either the subjective world, the purely subjective world, or of the purely objective material world without something I would call the collective individuality. That is the place where my person meets my culture, where it shakes hands with my culture. That would be the synthesis of these constant polarities in the book, the attempt to reach the moment where my individuality becomes part of a wider consciousness, a wider experience, of a cultural experience. If I reach it or not, if my characters reach it or not, is open to question, of course. But the way my mind worked in these novels is in this sense, Mike.
In the first story, The Two Shores, there's an almost astonishing finale in which Spain is being colonized by Mexican and South American explorers. There's
Indians.
Indians, but led as well by a Spaniard who's come to Mexico and whose friend has had his face tattooed, has married an Indian woman, has children with blonde hair but very dark features. But it's almost as if suddenly there's a reciprocal world going on. And this production of almost, in this book, Disneylands, dispopulated projections of a non-existent reciprocal culture, of a cross-pollination that simultaneously becomes, as the book continues, quite empty. You know, a ghost town, a town in which a rhetoric is created, but it doesn't correspond to a place.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I hadn't calculated that it was a Disneyland world. But of course, if we come to the last story, which is that of a Christopher Columbus, who keeps mum about his discovery for 500 years and is living in an archipelago called Antilia, which appears and disappears constantly.
Like Brigadoon.
Like Brigadoon. Then finally, he believes he is in Japan, and finally he is discovered by the Japanese and a consortium that creates a resort in this island called Paradise Incorporated, which is pure Disneyland, of course.
Yes,
it is
and
a
he
purely
becomes
ersatz civilization. It is a struggle also, of course, between ersatz plastic civilizations, commercial civilizations, and cultures that have a deeper meaning in the lives and thoughts and desires and memories of the people who live it. But isn't that what we are living today? This tremendous struggle that is going on between what we have decided to call the global village with its purely economic values and the local village with its loyalty to hearth and to the past and memory. and the language, and it's spilling over also into a kind of barbarism. We're caught between two terrible worlds and have yet to construct not the plastic world of the global village or what can be at times the murderous world of the local village, but a civilization that will give room for us all, that will accept us all in our diversity. Is that possible? Well, it's a question.
One would hope so, but at least in this set of novellas, mm-hmm. in The Orange Tree, published by Farrah Straus and Giroux, by the way, Columbus becomes simultaneously a character who's telling us the truth about himself. He announces that he's a Sephardic Jew who, not Italian at all, left Spain during the Inquisition. He is here. He prays to Spain, the mother. And yet, although he is revealing himself, he's being turned by the consortium that owns Paradise Inc. into the equivalent of an audio animatron.
Yeah.
Someone who, even if he elects at this point to tell us the truth, it can only come out in a kind of mechanical, unattended mumble.
Yes, he is transformed into a freak, as it were, by the commercial interests that take over the Antilles. He is given Banana Republic clothes and paraded along with naked slave girls, Indian slave girls, and all of this. It's a kind of carnival that is created. Yet I insist behind both the comic events of the book and the desolation that you rightfully find in it, in the book, the ghost-like emptiness, that can occur. My question is, nevertheless, that the play on the second opportunity for history is a serious play that is trying to say we must give history a second opportunity in order to reveal all that has been forgotten, in order to recover all that has been marginalized.
Is that in its way the most human sensual memories are round? They're of the breast, mm-hmm. in this book. The breast becomes, for Columbus, his original vision of a potentially round world, not an apple, we learn, but a pear.
Mm-hmm.
The pear being like a breast with its nipple. It seems as if the way of returning to history is through a recognition of more basic needs.
I would say so. I would say so. I think that, first of all, I would like to remark that what you have just quoted is one of the few instances in that novella in which I quote Columbus. It is Columbus himself in his diary writing of his conception of the world as a pear and as his mother's breast, and talking about his childhood and how he enjoyed his mother's breast. He talks about all this. So there is in him that sensuality of the roundness, which permits me to circulate amongst different sensualities, I think, in the book, in order to try to give sensuality to the idea that all occurs in the present, that sensuality is an act of the present in which the past and the future occur. I don't think that the past and the future as such exist. I think you and I exist in this moment, and we are remembering, and that is the only past we have. And in this precise moment, we're also desiring, and that is the only future we have. So I would also like to place the stories in a sensuality that drives towards a conception, a more global conception, a rounded conception of the living moment in which we are and all it contains.
Well, in The Orange Tree, language itself is seen as the product of a sensual act. It's something that is learned by its translators by sucking. From the breast, elsewhere as well, it's as if love itself is a communication of language almost inadvertently in this book.
I think the erotical is the supreme way of communicating. We are these strange animals that make love facing each other, seeing our faces. I think it was Burt Lancaster who said that. In the film where a band comes into Mexico to save Claudia Cardinale from the clutches of a Mexican bandit played by Jack Palance. Do you remember the title of that?
No, I will never know.
Robert Ryan is in it, and Lancaster says, wonders why human beings are, a man and a woman are the only animals that make love facing, looking at their faces, almost as if they needed to speak to each other in the moment. And the fact is that we do speak to each other when we make love. We do give a vocabulary to our eroticism, to our sensuality. And from there to writing novels and poems, it's a very short step, Michael, very short step.
It's funny that you bring up an actor, because one of the scariest stories in this, scary because so depersonalized and so caught in a kind of airless nimbus of manufactured space, is one called Apollo and the Whores, in which an actor who is comically the first American actor to win an Oscar for his performance in a foreign film narrates from beyond the grave the evening that leads to his suicide, a sort of Billy Wilder situation. I sensed in this book a progression toward the post-human, mm-hmm. with Columbus being the final avatar of this sort of world in which someone becomes a spokesperson for something he no longer represents. And I also sensed that the actor in this story, in some peculiar way, is an evolution or heir of the narrator in the first story. He seems to be some reincarnated and still more fallen version of a lost translator.
He says so. Vince Valera, the actor in the story, says so. He says he discovers two things when he dies. One is that the privilege of the dead is to read the minds of the living, so that he has died in this ecstasy of making love with seven women at the same time. What a way to go. And he discovers, as he goes from the little death, la petite mort, to the big death, that there is a privilege in dying, and it is that you can read the minds of the living. So that these women he had kind of made cartoons of, he calls them the seven girls and their madame, he calls them Snow White and the seven dwarfs. And he calls them Sneezy and Dopey and Doc. And when he dies, he is able to see in their minds and see the deaths they have in their minds and realize what their real names are. They're not called Doc. She's called Maria de la Gracia. She's not called Sneezy. She's called Soledad. And as they see him dead, they think of a death, and he sees what deaths they are thinking of. And in this way, he's able, he says, to individualize them, to de-Mexicanize them, to de-third world dice them, to enter into their lives. And the other privilege of death he discovers as an actor is that he is able, when he is buried under the orange tree, presumably planted by Cortés in the coast of Acapulco almost 500 years ago, that he is capable of acting out all the roles of the other novellas, that he can become the Roman general Scipio, he can become Cortés, he can become the sons of Cortés, he can become Columbus. He says, I can become this because it is a part of an incessant movement of conquest and counter-conquest and discovery and decadence and apogee acted out by the movement of people, the movement of peoples, the migrants, their hopes, the hopes for freedom, for justice of so many peoples. He is a part of that world. He is a Sephardic Jew expelled from Spain. So it all comes together in that story, which I think is the key story.
The pivot.
It's the pivot because it holds everything together. You know, it's based on a real event, on a real person.
Well, tell me.
The actor Steve Cochran, who played in many secondary roles in many films. He was in Wonder Man with Danny Kaye. He was in A Song Is Born. He seemed to play second fiddle to Danny Kaye and lose the girl to him, if you could believe it. He did a very he was in White Heat with Jimmy Cagney, always playing the role of secondary hoods. Then Antonioni gave him a great opportunity, a magnificent film called Il Grido. It's a black and white Antonioni film in which Cochran suddenly, for no reason at all, there is no explanation, he leaves his wife, his home, everything he has, and only takes his little girl by the hand, a 9-year-old girl, and goes out into the fog and the humidity of the River Po and the Milanese countryside in the winter. He just has to leave, but he has to take something that he loves with him, and that is this little girl. It's a very moving, powerful, emotional film, which Cochran made. Then his career declined. He went to Acapulco. He rented a yacht, took these girls with him, and the yacht was found drifting in front of the coast of El Salvador 5 days later with Cochran dead on the ship. So it's based on that incident.
As a, what, postmodern text, The Orange Tree seems to go very far in a direction that, at least for me in your work, is begun by Aura, toward ghostliness and toward the experience of life seen retroactively as existential, but not lived existentially in the present moment. Yeah. And it seems, I know this is a very cold world, a very cold vision. How does one return from it to a simpler human sense? Or can one?
Or can one, indeed. I have a deep sense in my writing, and it is something I share very much with Milan Kundera. We've talked a lot about this, and share this view of the death, not of the novel, but of the information a novel can give about living characters in order to make them believable and present them with a whole set of identity cards, as it were, so that you will know exactly who David Copperfield is or who Madame Bovary is. All the information is there. But this information becomes useless in a world where no one knows what their identity is. It becomes fake to give this kind of identity that was so abundant, so rich in a Balzac or Dickens, or even Dostoevsky novel, to the modern man as imagined by Kafka and by Beckett. K, of course, for a very good reason, has only an initial. And for a very good reason, Samsa wakes up one morning and finds out that he is a beetle. What do we do with the beetle? Do we squash the beetle? Do we trample it to death? Or do we look for a new construction of the human personality by what Novalis would call the figure, or almost, he doesn't say it in that sense, but it's almost what Henry James is talking about, the figure in the carpet, mm-hmm. the discovery of this unsuspected shape.
The internal pattern.
Yeah, and which I have practiced notably in Terra Nostra. I wanted very much to give the idea not of characters, because there are characters in Terra Nostra that are powerful, like the King of Spain. Well, there he is, and he has a genealogy behind him, and he has papers demonstrating who he is. But constantly, his destiny is being decided by three young men thrown on a beach in the Cantabric Sea, and with no sign of identity except a purple cross between their shoulder blades. Now, in this book also, I am groping towards that idea of a figure. That is, a character discovered in the moment of his greatest weakness. A character discovered in the moment in which he or she are constituting themselves. And this sometimes can be very spooky, or it can give a sense of death or of ghostliness, and yet it is the moment of the inception of life. It is the moment of the inception of life, which must be ghostly, which must be, I am sure, very, very proximate to death, the moment in which we are conceived, or in which we conceive something in our minds. So I would like to see in this book not the establishment of perfectly rounded, traditional, psychological, social characters, but the searching, the groping for what I call figures. Cortázar called it figures. Kundera calls it figures. It is this groping of, if you wish to call it, the postmodernist world, or anyway, a world that refuses to believe with Beckett that I do not exist. The fact is self-evident, as he says in one of his plays.
And yet it does give the feeling, these novels, of not of the death of the novel, not of the death of the author, but of the death of the human figure. That the human figure is replaced by a series of resonances, impositions, corporations, structures,
yep.
And the whole having the effect, as here, of a voiceover. Every Martin will have a second Martin to speak.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There will be, finally, nothing but the dispersion of atoms. It seemed, I guess, in this book, because others have had such bravura comic elements, this book seemed like Nabokov's Transparent Things to be the interpenetration of ghostlinesses, of ascending mm-hmm. anonymities.
It could be an anonymity that is ascending towards a new kind of personality. I insist very much in this, that probably we could be witnessing the birth of something new. And it is so proximate to the death of something old that we cannot very well distinguish the tomb from the womb, as it were, to use a Joycean expression. And we are groping towards a new kind of consciousness, a new kind that has to take risks besides. It has to take the risk of apocalypse, the risk of extermination, because we have seen it in our times, because we know this is inscribed in history, that this possibility is not something made up in one's mind, that historical violence is a very real thing. When you can kill 6 million Jews in a few years in Europe, what we're talking about is very serious, this possibility of going from the realm of existence to the realm of non-existence in history is something that can be very real. So I'm not shying away from this possibility of anonymity, as you call it, or ghostliness, but which is also perhaps a rite of passage. It is also perhaps a groping for something new, for something different. It is a refusal to stay with old categories that have led us to some of the worst crimes and disasters in all the history of humankind.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Carlos Fuentes, the author most recently of The Orange Tree, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a delight.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.